In the previous Taisho on the Diamond Sutra, we have seen that the Buddha's teaching and our practice is not bound by considerations of time and space. The Dharma does not enter in through the gates of our senses, but arises anew in each of us. Further, there is no fixed reality to the Dharma, and no Dharma to be attained. There is nothing that arises or passes away. And yet we speak of such things as Buddha and Dharma. The middle way is not affirmation that things exist, nor is it negation that nothing exists, but a transcendence, a letting go of existence and non-existence. The mountain is a no mountain, and therefore it is called a mountain. The merit of holding even a small piece of this sutra is boundless and unlimited, infinitely beyond anything that might be conventionally called alms. Because this sutra is itself enlightenment, enlightenment and all Buddhas come from it. Such merit is beyond any conceivable limit. Chapter 9. Subhuti, what do you think? Can one who has entered the stream think, I have attained the goal of stream entering? Subhuti replied, No, Bhagavan. Why? Because one who has entered the stream does not perceive entering anything. One does not perceive form, sound, scent, flavor, feeling, or dharma, meaning phenomena. Thus they are called stream enterers. If those who entered the stream should think, I have attained the goal of stream entering, they would be attached to notions about self, other, and existence in space and time. Subhuti, what do you think? Can one who returns once more think, I have attained the goal of one more returning? Subhuti replied, No, Bhagavan. Why? Because one who returns once more does not perceive any such dharma as going or returning. This is called once more returning. Subhuti, what do you think? Can one who returns no more think, I have attained the goal of non-returning? Subhuti replied, No, Bhagavan. Why? Because one who returns no more does not perceive any such dharma as non-returning. Thus they are called non-returners. Subhuti, what do you think? Can one who has attained freedom from birth and death, that is, arhatship, think, I have attained the goal of freedom from birth and death? Subhuti replied, No, Bhagavan. Why? Because one who has attained freedom from birth and death does not perceive any such dharma as freedom from birth and death. If such a one thinks, I have attained the goal of freedom from birth and death, there would still be an attachment to notions about self, other, and existence in space and time. How so? Bhagavan, the Tathagata has declared that I have attained the passionless samadhi, and that I am free of birth and death and of desires. I do not think I am free of birth and death and of desires. Bhagavan, if I thought I am free of birth and death and of desires, the Tathagata would not have said, Subhuti is foremost among those who are free from passion and dwells nowhere. Thus he is called one who is free from passion and dwells nowhere. through this questioning by the Buddha, Subhuti gives a detailed account of his practice. What we have here are the four stages of the Arhat's path: the stream enterer, the once returner, the non-returner, and the Arhat, who is free from birth and death. At least this is the Mahayana view of the Arhat, the individually enlightened one. This is not the path of the Bodhisattva that leads to Buddhahood. The Arhat has dropped all notions about self, other, existence in space or time. He is free from birth and death. He has entered nirvana all by himself. That's not it. Samadhi, the dropping away of birth, death, and the four delusive images that perpetuate the cycle of birth and death, is what we strive for in our practice, up to a point. Subhuti has reached an extraordinary level of samadhi. The Buddha says that he is foremost among those who are free from passion and dwells nowhere. But samadhi is not the goal. There is no merit in samadhi in and of itself. No matter how deep and silent, samadhi is not realization. Samadhi is just another state of impermanence. It is, however, a necessary condition. In the very first chapter of this sutra, it is from samadhi that Subhuti truly sees, the Buddha for the first time. But what is presented here is a notion of nirvana as a kind of dead-end samadhi, from which there is no return, and therefore no helping of others. I'm not sure that this is even possible, but if it is, then this nirvana is just another delusion. And there is the danger of getting stuck there. It's called making your living in a ghost cave. This deep silence that is so different from our crazy lives in the world can be very seductive. It's for this reason that we devote the last day of our session at this center to re-entry. And in principle at least, this re-entry is not just going back to business as usual. The transition is from the samadhi of emptiness to what Sekida calls active samadhi. This is the 10th ox herding picture, entering the marketplace with bliss-bestowing hands. All delusions have been left behind. The four delusive images are no more. Enlightenment is forgotten. Dana, relinquishment, is complete and never-ending. The first instruction of the Buddha in this sutra was, all beings without exception, regardless of origin, stage, or condition, I liberate them all, and yet not a single being is liberated. The many beings are numberless. I vow to save them. The first of the Bodhisattva vows. And this entire sutra is about the completion of Subhuti's education, as it were. Here is what Subhuti himself had to say in retrospect much later. Keep in mind that we're dealing with the Mahayana scripture here. Understand that Subhuti has become the spokesperson. He says, Bodhisattvas should not dwell on the perception that the fruits of the holy life derive their significance from the uncreated, or that the stream enterers are worthy of gifts and will be reborn 7 times at the most, or that once returners are worthy of gifts and will put an end to suffering after they have returned to this world one last time, or that non-returners are worthy of gifts and will not return to this world again but attain nirvana elsewhere, or that arhats are worthy of gifts and will in this very existence attain nirvana, nirvana that leaves nothing behind. For despite the cessation of their suffering, because they are incapable of further rebirths, arhats are unable to aspire to full enlightenment. Yeah. No fruits, no gifts, no merit on this path to the nirvana that leaves nothing behind. Do we really want that? What did the Buddha leave behind? What have all the ancestral teachers left behind? Good grief, where do I start? The list is endless. Many births, many deaths. I am serene in this cycle, says Yongja. I recall a Baptist preacher who said that the kingdom of heaven is not a spiritual roof garden. Nirvana is not an escape hatch. The freedom, the liberation of all beings, is not about a liberation from birth and death, but liberation as birth and death, and nirvana, and samsara, and everything in between. Chapter 10. The Buddha said, Subuddhi, what do you think? When the Tathagata was with Dipankara Buddha in the past, did he attain to any dharma? Subuddhi replied, No, Bhagavan, the Tathagata did not attain to any dharma when he was with Dipankara Buddha. The Buddha said, Subuddhi, if a bodhisattva should claim, I will transform a world, such a claim would not be true. And why? The transformation of a world is said by the Tathagata to be no transformation. Thus it is called the transformation of the world. Therefore, Subuddhi, a bodhisattva should not arouse the mind that dwells on sound, scent, flavor, feeling, or dharma. The bodhisattva should arouse the mind without dwelling on anything. Subuddhi, suppose a person had a perfect body, as great as Mount Sumeru. What do you think, Subuddhi? Would such a body be great? Subuddhi replied, Very great, Bhagavan. Why? Because the Tathagata says that such a body is not a body. Thus it is called a great body. Notice the repeating pattern here. A is not A, therefore it is called A. When the Tathagata was with Dipankara Buddha in the past, did he attain to any dharma? The Buddha's question refers to the story of the Bodhisattva, the future Buddha, who upon encountering Dipankara Buddha many kalpas ago, spread his hair over a mud puddle for Dipankara to walk on. Dipankara predicted that he would become a fully enlightened Buddha. Dipankara Buddha, transmitted nothing to Shakyamuni. If I say a horse is brown, have I conferred brownness upon the horse? Dipankara Buddha just saw what was to come in a couple of more infinite kalpas. The vast time spans referred to in this and other sutras are not meant to discourage. They point out that time is of no consequence, has no substance. All times are this time. All places are this place. Realizing that fully, Dipankara Buddha simply acknowledged reality. The Buddha said, Subuddhi, if a bodhisattva should claim, I will transform a world, such a claim would not be true. And why? The transformation of a world is said by the Tathagata to be no transformation. Thus it is called the transformation of the world. The great transformation that is no transformation and is therefore called transformation is the transformation of the endless suffering of samsara into the endless practice of enlightenment. To realize that there is nothing to be transformed and there is no agent of transformation is in itself a profound transformation. And yet nothing is transformed. Thus it is called the transformation of the world. Therefore, Subhuti, a bodhisattva, should not arouse the mind that dwells on sound, scent, flavor, feeling, or dharma. The bodhisattva should arouse the mind without dwelling on anything. Arouse the mind without dwelling on anything. This sentence is used as one of the introductory koans. But what about that quiet mind that we seek in our sitting? Can an aroused mind be a quiet mind? There is an assumption that there is a mind that dwells in stillness. But that's a false assumption. That is a search for a relative silence, a silence that is opposed to activity. This sounds a bit like the nirvana that was spoken of earlier, a dead-end samadhi. The aroused mind that the Buddha speaks of is not a mind that dwells in quietude or in activity, or here or there. It is a mind that does not attach to notions about self, other, or existence in space or in time. How do we do this? Arouse the mind without dwelling on anything. Do not attach or dwell anywhere. Not even in not dwelling. Maybe a good word to come at this is awareness. Awareness does not need an object. It need not be awareness of anything. Lex Hickson coined the word awakeness. The mind that is aroused and not dwelling anywhere is total awakeness. Total awakeness by its nature cannot be attached to anything because to attach to something is no longer to be awake. Consider your hands. There they are. Are they not fully aroused? Are they not fully what they are? Do they need any more arousing? Are they dwelling anywhere? Are they attached to some notion of being hands? Can they become any more hands than they are now? Is this lectern not fully itself, fully manifesting its nature? Enlightenment is really just to acknowledge this, to realize it, and to live out of that realization. Subhuti, suppose a person had a perfect body as great as Mount Sumeru. What do you think, Subhuti? Would such a body be great? Subhuti replied, very great, Bhagavan. Why? Because the Tathagata says that such a body is not a body. Thus it is called a great body. What is this body that is the size of Mount Sumeru? Mount Sumeru is the legendary center of the universe, unimaginably high and vast. What body could be so colossal as this? What does this great body do? How does it function? Layman Pong said, "My miracle is carrying wood and drawing water. Also walking, sitting, standing, eating, resting." The body of merit that arises with practice, that arises as practice, is beyond any comparison of size. The largest is the smallest too. Here limitations have no place, we chant in the verse on the faith mind. This very body, the body of Buddha, says Hakuin in the Zazen Wasan. This body is not a body, empty of any substance and therefore unlimited. Thus it is called a body. In the verse to case number 20 in the Wumen Guan, Wumen says, lifting my leg, I kick up the scented ocean. Lowering my head, I look down on the four Dhyana heavens. My body is so big, there is no place to put it. No place to put it. Where would you put the universe? The body of practice is so big it encompasses nirvana, samsara, and everything in between. Chapter 11. The Buddha said, Subhuti, what do you think? If there were as many rivers as there are grains of sand in the Ganges, would the number of grains of sand in all those rivers be great? Subhuti replied, very great, Bhagavan. The number of rivers would be great. How much more so their grains of sand? The Buddha said, Subhuti, I tell you the truth. If a good man or good woman were to fill the number of universes as great as the number of sand grains in all those rivers with all conceivable precious jewels and gave these as a gift to all arhats, tathagatas, and fully enlightened ones, would the body of merit produced by such an action be great? Subhuti replied, very great, Bhagavan. The body of merit produced by such an action would be immeasurable and infinite. The Buddha said, Subhuti, if a noble son or daughter accepts and holds even one four-line gatha of this sutra and teaches it to others, the body of merit produced would be immeasurably, inconceivably greater. Take as many rivers as there are grains of sand in the Ganges. Fill the number of universes as great as the number of sand grains in all those rivers with all conceivable precious jewels and give these as a gift to all arhats, tathagatas, and fully enlightened ones. This is where the Buddha amplifies that earlier metaphor in chapter 8, beyond just a paltry billion worlds, to the number of grains of sand in the Ganges multiplied by the number of grains of sand in the Ganges, and not just worlds, but universes. This is the Buddha's stratagem, as Red Pine points out, to expand our minds beyond all limitations. And, of course, we're not really talking about sand, but about microscopic particles of mud. The American mathematician Edward Kassner was contemplating the number of subatomic particles in the entire universe, and he thought that 10 to the power of 100 was pretty close. That's a 1 followed by 100 zeros. He asked his young nephew what was the biggest number he could possibly think of. And the boy said, a Google. That's spelled G-O-O-G-O-L, not like the search engine. Nevertheless, that vast number is still a number and therefore limited. You know, with a few samples from the river bottom and a modern computer, one could probably come up with a pretty good estimate of the total. And it would be a finite number. And only a small fraction of a Google. Thus, the merit accumulated by a gift to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, orders of magnitude greater than that mentioned back in chapter 8, is still limited and finite. That karmic merit is dwarfed to the infinitesimal by the gift of the Dharma itself. The Buddha, a master of analogy, is unhinging our minds from any calculation or numbers or magnitude. If you try to encompass this body of merit with the discursive intellect, you are on a fool's errand. If a noble son or daughter accepts and holds even one four-line gatha of this sutra and teaches it to others, the body of merit produced would be immeasurably and conceivably greater. Now please understand, I do not say, nor do I believe this sutra says, that charity in the ordinary way of things is bad or useless. It's wonderful. We have ceremonies of aid in which we give to a charitable organization selected by one of our members. We donate canned goods to local food banks. Most of us probably have our own pet charities that we write checks to whenever we can. But if we do so as alms in the usual sense, or engage in a cost-benefit analysis of who we give to, where is the money going, and so on, and I'm certainly guilty of that, what we gain is pretty bits of glass. They're nice to look at, but not much long-term value. Meister Eckhart said, "To give 100 marks to build a cathedral is good. To give 100 marks for nothing is better. To give as dhanaparamita, the transcendent perfection of relinquishment, the body of merit goes beyond any notions of large, small, past or future. When we give from that place, from that practice, with no notions about self, other, existence and space or time, whatever we give becomes a four-line gatha, whose merit is beyond calculation, beyond imagining. Dana becomes directionless. In the practice of this directionless dana, everything we do is an offering. Everything we receive is a gift. Any thought of magnitude misses it. Together with all beings, we realize the way."